We had a hearing last week on it, and we're going to continue because some folks didn't get a chance to testify. First up, I would like Chuck Shekinah to come to the stand, please.
I saw Nicholas Coop taking an oath. It's going to be a mistake. Somebody got the earned income tax credit together with returns to field burning. I don't think he's going to have to talk about returns to field burning, is he?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carol Shekatoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. This is a nonprofit research institute located in Silverton that looks into tax, budget, and public policies important to low and moderate income Oregonians, the majority of Oregonians. I'm pleased to provide you with a copy of our recent report addressing the high cost of child care, House Bill 2716, making the working family child care credit refundable. Credit recognizes one of the most daunting challenges faced by low-income working families with children, the ability to afford child care. It'll ultimately, if this bill passes, it could provide direct relief to some 50,000 low-income working families. This paper examines the effect of the current non-refundable policy and discusses the benefits of making it refundable. And as you will see, making it refundable will get the benefits to those most in need. Child care affordability is of great concern to many working families with children, and the need to find accessible, quality care at reasonable cost has more urgency today than ever before. More single-parent families are in the workforce as a result of welfare reform, and from the late 1970s to the late 1990s, the share of working families with children who are still poor doubled up to one out of seven, and the number of hours that households worked increased over that time period. I'm going to show you a few overheads to explain the nature of the problem that this bill hopes to address, and then at the end I'd like to just mention one of suggested amendment to the bill.
First, I would make the point to the Revenue Committee's each session to see this quote. This is one of my favorite quotes from a former chair of a Minnesota Revenue Committee. When I chaired the Appropriations Committee, I saw the poor. When I chaired the Tax Committee, I saw the rich. This is your opportunity to see a program that affects the poor and low income. First, in your packet, you have this chart, and all the materials I'm putting up here are in your packet. And this gives you a sense, when you hear who are the poor, this bill gives a 40%, the law today gives a 40% credit to people up to 200% of poverty for tax year 2001, which was the final year next year, not this year. And then it phases down to zero at 250% of poverty. And poverty is defined by size of family by the federal government. It goes up with an inflation factor every year, comes out in February or March. And this shows for you a sense of how wealthy or how poor families are. That, for instance, a three-person family earning $29,250 theoretically can get a 40% credit for tax year 2001, and they won't lose their credit. It will go down to zero once they reach $36,575. That's what that chart gives you a little perspective. This chart shows data from our report from Prairie Perspective that we distributed to the legislature. And the fact that I mentioned in my introduction that this shows the poverty rate among working families with children. Take all working families with children and try to figure out what percentage of them are poor. Back in the late 70s, it was around 7%. Now it's 15.2%, 15.1%, over 15%. So it's actually more than doubled over a 20-year period. And this is despite the fact that our minimum wage went up, and despite the fact that in the late 70s, they actually had one of the highest minimum wage was at a higher point when adjusted for inflation. So this sort of somewhat reflects the eroding value of the minimum wage.
And it shows the need for low-income tax relief to address this problem. Before I show the next slide, I'd just like to say that I think it's important with this credit, see this credit as, this is a credit to help with child care costs. It's a way of subsidizing child care. It's not a credit to lower someone's taxes, per se. I think that's the bill you're going to be addressing later. The earned income credit deals with tax burden of people. This is a credit for a targeted group of people who have a significant cost because they're in the workforce, and it requires that you be in the workforce for almost half time. And so it's a subsidy for child care. It's not really a way of lowering someone's taxes. That's not what it was designed for. It was designed to help with the child care costs.
This chart, which is in the report, it is 4 and 5 or 5 and 6, correctly, shows the nature of the problem. It shows that people from minimum wage through about, this is for a three-person family, through about $13.50 are supposed to be getting a 40% child care credit. And then it phases down to zero at 250%. This is for a, this starts done for a three-person family, in the tax year 2001, we recommended the tax table in 2001, and it shows what the credit should be. What's actually happening, though, is the gray area. The gray area is the credit they get because they don't have enough tax liability in proportion to, or enough income in proportion to their high child care costs. This chart assumes this three-person family has two children in school-age care in a family center. It's the statewide market rate for that, according to a survey by the Department of Human Services performed by OSU. The table at the bottom shows what's really happening. It shows that if this person had that $8,400 in child care expenses under the bill, as it's worded, they should be getting a subsidy of $3,350 until their income gets up to about $1,350. Instead, they're getting, the minimum wage person is getting $34, and the person at $1,550 is getting $1,700. That means that person at $1,550 is getting 51 times the subsidy for their child care. Even though they both work at the same place, have their child in the two children at the same child care center, have the same monthly expense for child care, the person that's earning $1,550 is getting a bigger subsidy from the state. Where it was supposed to be, that person was supposed to get a lower subsidy on the step down of the rate. By making the credit refundable, you fill in this portion here and make the credit do that which it was designed to do, which is give the maximum credit to people up to 200% of poverty, and then phase it down. Other credits in Oregon that are either designed to offset costs or give direct tax relief generally have carry forwards. And a carry forward works where you can't use the credit, you don't have enough tax liability, so you can carry it forward 3, 5, sometimes 10 years, depending on the credit. The other two child care credits on the books have 5-year carry forwards. Carry forwards would not work with low-income folks. It was considered in 97 when this bill passed for a variety of reasons. One, you have to keep records from year to year. Second, you'd never get to use it unless your expense went away, the child care, or your income went up. Otherwise, each year you'd keep accumulating this amount that you're not using. And so a carry forward really doesn't work. You know, something on the order of 17% of the personal exemption credit isn't claimed because people don't earn enough to get the personal exemption credit. That doesn't have a carry forward, but most credits on the books have carry forwards, but it would not work with a low income credit because it assumes that the expense goes away or income would have to go up or both, and that's not likely to occur. The one, I'd be happy to answer questions. I want to address the one suggested amendment. And I can't remember why, I remember why the main provision was written. I don't remember why the, well, anyway, the credit required, there was concern when this passed that people be working, students can use it, but we said, let's have someone have some work effort, and the dollar amount was $6,000. This was in 1997. And I can't remember why an inflator was put into that, but if you look in the bill on page 3, you'll see it gets inflated. So this tax year, for tax year 2000, people are filing right now, people have to have a minimum income of $6,300. Well, in a few years, that'll get up to $6,500, which is about half time at minimum wage, if our minimum wage doesn't go up. And I think there should be some consideration given to capping it either right now at $6,300 and stop the inflation, or just say X% of
work at minimum wage, so if the minimum wage does ultimately go up by the voters or by the legislature, it sort of can move with it. But otherwise, at a certain point, you're going to have to work over half-time to even use this credit. And in today's economy, a lot of people are having, because of the nature of the economy, having to work part-time, and that's why I think it should get stopped. I think there's still some value in having some minimal work effort. There was a concern that sort of have some minimal work effort, and that's why 6,000, and I didn't realize, frankly, that it had an inflator until 2 years later when we started putting together this analysis of why it needed to be refundable. And it's starting to get up there, and I think it ought to be capped. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have concerning the measure.
Can you remind those of us who were on the committee last session, those of us who were, what happened? Didn't we have this bill before us last session?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill as it passed in 97, when it left the Senate initially on a 30-0 vote, was refundable. And it was both the earned income, the bill that in 97 contained both the earned income and the working family credit. They're in one bill. Then a May revenue forecast came out with about $141 million more, a little different times than we have this spring. And Senate President Adams, the startup date of that bill was a biennium out. So the committee had the pleasure of not having to worry about the fiscal. They had a dollar amount they had to keep the bill within, but it wasn't, they could deal with just the policy. When that fiscal came out, Senate President Adams had the committee move the bill again with an earlier startup date, and it put the bill into the budget battle of the 97 legislature. It passed the Senate with, I think it was 26-4 vote. The Democrats, after failing on a minority report, did not support it. Got to the House, but now it was a part of the budget debate, and when the House, when they negotiated the budget, they left only about $30 million for a $90 million bill, and the only way to fix it was to make them, make it fit that hole, was to make them non-refundable, and that's what happened. So it passed the Senate refundable originally, and because of the budget, became non-refundable. Last session, there was a bill put in to expand it. Originally, the bill was a 40% credit up to 150% of poverty, and then phased out at 200%. They just added 50% to both of those numbers, 40% credit up to 200%, as I've shown you, down to 250. And that came out of the Senate, Senate Bill 2, got to the House, and the Revenue Committee last session, House Revenue Committee, put out and passed the House floor with a, I think it's in my report, 49-something vote, I believe, that it be refundable, and went back to the original smaller income groups. And then in conference committee, went with the Senate-passed version. Much to my surprise, last session, the revenue cost of the refundable versus the expansion was cheaper, and for what reasons I still to this day don't understand, they went with the more expensive expansion, knowing that fixing the problem this session would be more expensive. The fix is on a biennial basis. This first biennium is $14 million, I think it's a good investment to make as far as priorities of the legislature.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shikatapa, are you saying it'd be $14 million this coming biennium to make the credit refundable for all of the taxpayers that currently otherwise qualify for the credit?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, yes. For we did, and then that what we did was we looked at census and Oregon population survey data to estimate the number of homes, households, and families that are at 250% of poverty and pay for child or lower and pay for child care. Gave that to Legislative Revenue Office. They updated their analysis using 1998 tax data that came out this past winter, and for the if it started for tax year 2001. Which is what the expansion started, for the 2001-2003 biennium, the total cost of this bill would be $14.1 million.
Do we have a fiscal on this bill here yet?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, this sheet was passed out the first time these bills were heard.
Okay.
And it summarizes what some of the impacts are. It lists for a refundable working family child care credit about an $8 million annual impact or $16 million biennial. These are rough. I think what I did was rounded up to $7 to $8 million. but I think Chuck's number is more recent and more correct based on the work I've done recently.
If I may, Madam Chair? If I may, I think the number, in some ways, is conservative. We haven't analyzed the numbers of what legislative revenue is used for how much people pay in childcare, because that obviously affects what the 40% credit is. But I think it's conservative as far as assuming a very high percentage of the eligibles will use the credit. Currently, in 1998, the most recent data that's in the tax expenditure report showed 17,800 people, households, use the credit. The LRO's analysis assumes around 40,000 out of the 49,000 that are eligible. I don't think it's going to be that many. I think if that happens, and I'll claim that our outreach effort, which you've sent to your offices, is very successful. I know what it's based on, so I worked with Ed on this. It's based on nationally for the, I couldn't find anything for the dependent care credit nationally, but we looked at the earned income credit, which is a very popular, easier credit to use, and nationally that has an 86% utilization rate. That's what he used. So I think it's $14 million is conservative. I'm not going to go to the bank on it, but I think it's I don't think it's a risky estimate, and I think it's based on what we know for track record, especially this first biennium.
Follow up? Chuck, do you think that if we're looking at investing some dollars either into a working family child care credit or a refundable earned income credit, do you see this program as having more merit, in terms of looking where priorities would rest with the legislature?
Madam Chair, Representative Wood, that's an excellent question. If you look at my memorandum to the committee, low-income advocates have prioritized this ahead of that. I think they're both needed. They both do two different things. One addresses the work-related expense, tremendous work-related expense of child care for working folks, low income. The other one addresses the tax burden and tax threshold of low-income people, regardless of whether they have child care. But for the reasons stated in those bulleted items, we do think it is a priority. First, it's more inequitable. Currently, the EIC, because it's so small at 5%, if you work full-time at minimum wage, you're getting it. It's only the people who work part-time or less than a full year. The inequity isn't in sheer dollar amounts isn't as much. If this is a typical family, and I don't know if it is, with $8,400 of child care costs, but we have reason to believe it might be somewhat typical, they're losing out on $3,000 at a 5% credit where your maximum EIC is around $3,300. You're not losing out on that much. They both essentially target families with children, although there's a few people in the EIC, very small EIC for people who don't have children. But this targets those with children who, that's a big problem for them to be in the workforce because of the child care costs. Okay? I will tell you that I don't subscribe to the theory that some proponents of this bill do, that this means more people will be able to get into the workforce or anything. It's paid at the end of the year. It doesn't lend itself to advance payments. I wouldn't recommend that. And so I don't think it's going to affect who's in or out of the workforce. I just won't make those claims. I do think it'll be a nice thing they get back, and that's why low-income people file the EIC relatively early, because they want that federal one. And I think it'll help people deal with all the bills they've been putting off because they've had such high child care costs. It is the one negative side of it is that we haven't figured a way to fix. I don't think there is a fix, frankly, is it doesn't happen monthly. That's a problem.
It's like a tax refund is what it is in essence.
Right.
And it's limited to 40% of your child care expense.
The maximum is 40%, and it goes down from there if your income goes above 200% of poverty.
Okay, thank you.
Just to make it clear, my own mind, you picked some sort of artificial but meaningful breakpoints here, 250% of the poverty level, 200% of poverty, 100% of poverty level.
Okay, that's sure. They're not, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, they're not artificial. Those are the breakpoints in the statute.
Okay, but I mean, they're continuing. My question is, the $14 million you're talking about, it goes up to 250% of the poverty level. If you stopped it at 200% or you stopped it at 100%, do you have figures for those two?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I haven't, because that would be a scale back, which would require a three-fifths vote by the legislature. It would be raising people's taxes by getting rid of that credit for them. And I think that the expansion I was not in support of the expansion. I think rolling it back would be wrong, especially any lower than it was. When the bill was debated in 97, the original bill had the credit up to like 100% of poverty. And the reason it was written to 150% was the Senate Revenue Committee understood when we explained to them the issue that was explained to this committee last week, that the poverty level was established on a formula back in the 1960s when the largest item in a family budget was food. And it understates what self-sufficiency is. I did want to, though, address, and it's related to that, is your question last week, which I think our report does answer, but I want to address it, about the interplay between this and the subsidy program, the employment-related daycare program. If you're in the employment-related daycare program, you have a copay. That copay is subject to getting this credit. Okay? So it works with that copay. Under the governor's budget, a lot of people will be, and under the co-chair's budget, people would be losing employment-related daycare. Currently, the rule is you can get into the program if you have income up to 185% of poverty. Under the governor's budget, it would go down to 160%. And the co-payments will go up for 80% of the, are going to go up for 80% of the participants. That program has about 12,500 families. It's not slated to grow. So this actually is a way of offsetting some of those increase. 40% essentially of the increase in copay could get offset if we can get those people using this credit and get the state to do the outreach and help us with that. And so an employment-related daycare serves a very small portion of the eligible people. It's a very small program. There's a chart in our report showing the decline in welfare caseload and the very slight increase of the employment-related daycare program. It just hasn't met the need for a variety of reasons we don't need to go into. But someone who's in that program, if they have child care expenses, can use this credit.
Unfortunately, I need to step out. I am being paged by my child care, so Representative Williams is going to take over for
me. Nice job. Are there any other questions for Chuck? Good. Thank you very much. Mr. Castagna, if you'd come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Castagna, director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. And with the chair's permission, may I address both the working family child care credit and the state earned income tax credit that you also have on the agenda today?
You may. Tell me that. What's that bill number?
House Bill 2032.
Okay. We'll also open a simultaneous hearing on House Bill 2032.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Anthony Granados, who's also on the staff of the Oregon Catholic Conference, to join me. Mr. Chair, we're handing out to you as testimony some background history for the benefit of this committee. The discussion about the state earned income tax credit began in 1988. The first bill was introduced in the 1989 session of the legislature in the form of Senate Bill 249, and it was filed at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Revenue and School Finance for the Lutheran Office on Public Policy, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and the Oregon Catholic Conference. That began an 8-year discussion with the legislature regarding the creation of a state-earned income tax credit. And the purpose for beginning that discussion was related to an approach adopted by the federal government in 1986 with federal income tax reform. And the purpose of the 1986 federal income tax reform was to eliminate from a federal tax obligation all people below poverty. And what we were trying to do was to eliminate from a state tax obligation those people who, by definition, were poor, living in poverty, so that they did not have a state income tax obligation. If you notice on the face of Senate Bill 249 from the 1989 session, that bill was introduced with the hoped-for level of a 50% earned income tax credit at the state level. Well, finally, in 1997, so 8 years later, the state adopted the 5% state earned income tax credit based as a percentage of the federal earned income tax credit. For 8 years, I had a running conversation with Richard Munn, who was the director of the State Department of Revenue, And the conversation went something like this: Richard, are you working on my favorite project? And Richard responded by saying, Bob, I go to sleep at night thinking about the state earned income tax credit. So finally, 8 years later, during the height of the great economic boom that this country saw, but also following by 2 years the adoption of welfare reform, the state finally moved into the state earned income tax credit. Because in 1995, we had the discussion at the state legislature of moving people from welfare to work. We believe the conversation now must move not only from moving people from welfare to work, but moving people from welfare to work and out of poverty. That's where we are seeking to move this discussion. If you look in the Legislative Fiscal Office's report, Mr. Britton did an analysis of the Adult and Family Services Division budget, and he had a comparison chart, national and state poverty rates. And these are raw numbers, and there's a margin of error, but these are the raw numbers. In the United States as a whole, the United States poverty rate moved in 1994-1995 was at 14.2%. In 1988-1999, it was at 12.3%. So you had a drop in the U.S. poverty rate of 1.9%. In Oregon in 1994-95, and this is U.S. Census Bureau survey poverty data, the state poverty rate was 11.5%. In 1988-99, the state of Oregon was at 13.8%. So that while the U.S. went down 1.9%, the rate of poverty in Oregon went up 2.3%. And at this point, Oregon 98-99 figures were 1.5% higher in Oregon than the national figures. Now, the report cautions these data show that the national two-year averages went down from 94 to 99. During the same time, the two-year average percentages of Oregonians living in poverty remained roughly stable or rose insignificantly, given the standard error inherent in the survey data. But in terms of raw numbers, Oregon's rate went up, contrary to the national direction. The Oregon Catholic Conference's goals this session are to maintain the safety net of state programs for vulnerable persons. We, as Mr. Sheketoff has have indicated, have declared a priority for the Working Family Child Care Credit over the State Earned Income Credit because more relief will be extended to working poor families. So we prefer the Working Family Child Care Credit just in terms of the number of dollars that will flow to poor families. While we have prioritized, if this legislature had to make the very difficult choice between maintaining the safety net and extending tax credit relief, our preference at this point is to maintain the safety net of programs. Now, there are all sorts of conversations that occur during the legislative session, and we see in today's paper the indication that the chair of this committee is engaged in a conversation regarding revenue restructuring. So we think it is wise to send both of these bills on their way through the process to at least have them in the discussion. So we do prioritize the Working Family Child Care Credit over the State Earned Income Tax Credit, but we think it is also wise for the legislature to have both of these on the table. And I say that because one of the primary reasons for us asking the Revenue Committee during the interim for the introduction of House Bill 2032 was to begin the discussion of tax equity in this session. And this committee has, as part of its title, the name Tax Fairness. And the reason I raise that is that we have looked at the impact of Ballot Measure 88, increasing the deductibility of federal income taxes from $3,000 to $5,000. And we've studied some of the figures in terms of the impact projected by the Revenue Committee staff. And we noticed that 31% of the taxpayers, those having incomes $50,000 and higher, receive about 80% of the benefit. And you're looking at a revenue impact in this biennial budget of about $159 million, and in 2003-05, about a $249 million impact. Now, from Catholic social teaching perspective, we ask three questions. What does this do to the poor? What does it do for the poor? And how do the poor participate in it? Well, when we look at Measure 88 and the combination of more than $400 million of tax relief over a four-year period, and then we look at the legislature's difficulty this session of looking at the Department of Human Services budget, a budget that we're told by staff within the department is maybe $130 million short of current revenues, current service level, and then we look at how the poor are excluded from the impact of Measure 88, that raises fundamental moral questions for us in terms of the moral decision-making of our tax policy. If the programs for the poor are threatened in that the safety net will have gaping holes in it, and if we're looking at the distribution of these resources, we have to ask, is this fundamentally a moral policy? And I guess when I look at the impact and who's going to participate in tax relief, if we are at the state where the state of Oregon is in a position to afford tax relief to the taxpayers of the state, the question that arises in our mind is, how are the poor going to participate in this? I'd like Mr. Granados to address a little bit further the issue from a Catholic social teaching perspective.
Mr. Chair, esteemed members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Granados with the Oregon Catholic Conference. In addition, I'm also an adjunct professor of history at Portland State University. And one of my impetus for being here with Mr. Castagna this session is to bring a philosophical and theological insight into our activity here in the Capitol. So largely, I'm asking the question of why. And I'll keep my comments brief, but to quote Pope John Paul II in recent encyclical, Faith and Reason, "Faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. Thus, for us, issues such as House Bill 2032 and House Bill 2716 are not simply and only a matter of justice, but also of sound public policy." And largely, I speak a lot about the issue of the common good. And the common good, traditionally in Catholic social teaching, has effectually been about the role of government and its relationship to society as a whole in promoting justice, and so that the citizens might not just simply live, but live well within a given political state. And as Mr. Castagna mentioned, with regard to House Bill, or to Measure 88, which has passed, this issue is also a matter of equity for us, a matter of justice, which we understand to be rendering unto either the person or the community that which they are due. And we ask that with House Bills 2032 and 2716, an important component of these are the refundability aspect, because in many respects, poor people do not have a tax liability. And if you make these refundable, it'll be good for them. This issue is really a beginning of a larger discussion about poverty in the state of Oregon, a larger discussion that the state needs to address. But we think initially this will have some impact on the poor. And if our state faces a constricted revenue system, increasing likelihood of a recession, we ask the question how the poor are going to be addressed in the future, both immediately and the far-reaching. And we do believe that with House Bill 2032 and 2716, that this could initially have a good impact on the least of our body politic. And part of Catholic social teaching, as Mr. Castagna has noted, we do prioritize, and part of Catholic social teaching throughout the centuries has been to have a preferential option for the poor, because they're the least amongst the body politic. They're the most vulnerable to a lot of the public policy issues that happen in places such as the state capital. And so we ask that these be kept in mind in deciding on issues such as House Bill 2032 and 2716. So, as I mentioned in the beginning, I bring a question of why and then how this is going to affect the poor, the least of our body politic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Granados and Mr. Castagna. Are there questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When Mr. Sheketoff was testifying, he raised the point that a refundable credit comes back at the end of the year when you file your tax return. So often you don't see it until February, March maybe April the succeeding year. In the meantime, you have the expense, and for a low-income family, things like childcare expense puts a tremendous pressure upon the budget, family budget. Is there not a better way of addressing this, namely some kind of a specific monthly, quarterly subsidy assistance to families based upon their maybe their previous year's income, level of expense, so that they get assistance during the year as opposed to using the tax mechanism in essence to create a refundable credit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, you raise a very excellent point, and it's my understanding that that is available under the federal earned income tax credit, that families can claim that credit in advance and receive those funds during the course of the year. We would support that type approach if the state would find itself able to move in that direction. One of the things we're most mindful of is a study that was released by some University of Oregon professors on welfare reform in Oregon. I want to bring these specific factors to your attention. The authors of the report are concerned that far too many families are falling through the gaping holes in our state's safety net programs. Half the families they surveyed had incomes below the poverty line. One-third were not employed. The average take-home pay for employed heads of household was about $1,000 a month. Right now, one out of every 5 to 6 Oregon children live in poverty. We believe that's a crisis for the state of Oregon when you have somewhere between 16% and 20% of the children in your state living, our state, living in poverty. And that's why we would urge this legislature to adopt a vision that it is not sufficient to move people from welfare to work, but that we must also move them out of poverty. And when you take a look at balancing the equities in terms of the more than $400 million of tax relief provided by Measure 88 over the next 4 years, when you look at the Adult and Family Services Division budget, and when you look at even the revenue impact of this measure in combination with the Working Family Child Care Credit, they don't come anywhere close to the $400 million in tax relief that is going to be provided for families with total incomes above $50,000. So we would urge this legislature, because not only is it just and is it moral, but we think it's necessary for the kids of this state to move them out of poverty and to have a life that is truly meaningful. So we would urge this legislature to stretch as much as it can in justice and in equity to provide the tax relief that these families so justly need and deserve.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So, and back to that point, Bob, I mean, have there been discussions, for example, with the Department of Revenue to see if there's some way in which we can implement a refundable credit based upon quarterly income or monthly income and child care expense? And I wonder if there's some way in which we can't, I mean, if we're going to move forward with this kind of relief, which seems to have a tremendous amount of merit, isn't there some mechanism that we can use to give this relief on a monthly basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, we would welcome and support this committee engaging the Department of Revenue in such a conversation to make that happen.
Okay, you haven't had those?
We have not.
Okay.
Further questions for either of these witnesses? Good. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ellen Lowe for House Bill 2716.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm a legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. And if I may, I do know that Mr. Sheketoff has researched the question that Representative Witt just asked. And so perhaps to keep things in context, if you'd like to have him come and join me and answer that question now.
Mr. Sheketoff is always welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I promise I won't call you at 11:30 at night. Chuck Sheketoff. The federal EIC does have an advance payment option. It's for 40%, approximately 40% of the EIC, and the way the federal government protects itself in case you're working and you're getting your EIC at one income and then you stop working and they would have paid you too much in the advance is it's limited essentially because the EIC's purpose was to offset not only the income tax, but primarily also FICA, federal other worker taxes. It's limited to the withholding of FICA. And so that's why there's no risk to the government, really, limited risk to the government. Okay. The advance payment on the federal level, the maximum credit on the federal EIC, as you'll learn when we get to that, when I talk about that, is about $3,800. And so the advance payment is about $130 a month. One would think a lot of low-income families would participate, even to the dismay of their employers who have to do a little more paperwork, frankly, for the advance payment. It has a very low participation rate. And some university researchers, the gentleman who was here about a month or so ago, have studied it, and they've basically found that people sort of like getting that big check at the end, and that while they're all good budgeters and stuff, it just, and people, and a lot of us do outreach for the advance EIC, it just hasn't met the expectations that Congress thought and advocates thought. And people are still trying, but most people, they don't want to see it go away, but it just doesn't get used well, and employers don't want it. When it came to the Oregon EIC, your Oregon EIC, your maximum payment at a 5% EIC is going to be $198. To divide that by 12, it's not a lot a month. And we talked about it in 97. Chair was a small businessman, a lawyer, and said, you know, I don't like having to do the advance payment bookkeeping anyway. And it just didn't make sense with such a small one. And then on the child care credit, you have the problem of the state's not sort of, you don't have that offset like you do on the federal FICA. And so the state would be at sort of risk. So we couldn't figure out a way to do an advanced child care credit. And the ERDC program, which is a monthly subsidy, just doesn't work that well to capture the nature of the need.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the third, Mr. Chairman, well, I said that to in the last 10 minutes here.
Pardon? I just want to comment. I'm glad I got here in time to be insulted as a chair who is a small businessman lawyer.
I don't think that was you.
That was the, it was the prior. It was the House Senate
that's
revenue.
Talking about you 4 years
ago. That's right. Did you have a follow-up?
I did, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Thank you. Chuck, in this case, though, with the working family child care credit, you could be looking at a credit that's, what, as much as $3,000?
Or more. That's right.
Uh-huh. So when you talk about breaking this out over a number of payments over the course of the year, it has a much bigger impact than what you have with the EIC.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rick, that's correct. The problem is, one, it's the risk to the state. It's all sort of paperwork going. You'd have to have someone apply. I mean, the beauty of the working family credit is there's no sort of process to apply. It's part of the tax form. So you'd have to, if you want the advance payment, you'd have to somehow have some type of proof and all of that of what are your child care costs, for the employer to verify to the state that that's why they're not sending in the money. And so I think there's certain risks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see some way in which you can work it through the employer? In other words, the employer would fill out a form, the person would verify their actual child care expense, submit a form, the employer signs off on the form, to create some safeguards in this and make the paperwork flow a little more smoothly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I'm not going to suggest things to put burdens on business, on the employers at this point. I just don't think it's right to, and I think you get into verification problems. And then what if the person's income goes down? They start working January 1, but you haven't been paying that tax, and they quit March 1st, and they haven't met the $6,300 income threshold for this credit. You haven't sent in the taxes on it. I mean, that's the problem. There are certain problems of the person's life changing over the course of a year, which would affect their taxes. Or they may get a raise. And so they may go from 40% credit, they may switch jobs, get a with a different employer, get it go up, down to a 15% credit. So now they still didn't have enough money taken out. So you have those risks because people's life changes. So the beauty of the federal one is it's tied to their FICA, and that's the risk of the only risk. And that's why it's set at 40%. You're right. At $3,800, it would be a significant amount, just like the 40% of the federal one is significant. $130 a month is a pretty nice chunk of change to get.
Ellen, I think you, I'm sorry, Representative Bates, did you?
Can I ask a question since you're up?
Sure,
right here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll go back to employer-rated daycare services again, which is, this whole thing is very confusing to me, and I think obviously confusing to some other people, maybe not to everybody. You prioritize 2716 over 2130. if you try looking at ERDC and deciding which of you, if you had to choose, you had to make Sophie's choice here, which program would be the best one for these people? Or is it something you just can't do? And if you can't do it, I understand that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, and members of the committee, I don't like to play Solomon, and you folks are elected, but I will tell you that if I were given a choice, I would put it into the working family credit for a variety of reasons. It meets a bigger share, potentially a much bigger share of the families who need the child care assistance. It also, the employment-related daycare is subject to being changed, administrative rules through rebalances of the approval of the e-board throughout the biennium, and has gotten worse at times during the biennium. This past biennium it got better, but now a governor's budget's making it worse. The working family credit to take away requires a 3/5 vote if you're going to make it less rich for folks. And so I would, frankly, if I had to make that choice, I think they both deserve, I should tell folks, the employment-related daycare is taking $18.5 million in cuts. If you look at the governor's budget, you won't see that because 9.5 of them, they enriched the program in March, but they did it, they didn't follow the bureaucratic hurdles, and so they sort of got their wrist slapped, and they said, this does not become a part of continuing service level. So the governor doesn't even have to report that $9.5 million cut as a cut, even though as of July 1, it's going to go down to 165% of poverty and co-payments are going to go up. That's not a cut in the governor's budget. It's a cut in my budget, my reading of the governor's budget. But technically it isn't. We're only a lawyer writing the budget for a budget writer, right? And so it's $18 million that program is short. About 14 of it is directly affecting clients. About $4 million is affecting the lack of a COLA for the providers. And if I had to make that choice, I would put the first 14 here if it was just between those two. But I also would say, and I'm going to address this when I talk about the earned income credit, I think there are other budget options available, and I'll wait till we call the earned income credit bill.
Chair and members of the committee, again, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. I should learn to give way to...
Be careful who you ask to come up, right?
Yes, actually, in a way, I ought to just say amen and sit down, because what I was going to do was going to go back through the history, because I was involved in Senate Bill 249. And so I have been part of the history of this concept from the very beginning. But I also recall that when Jerry Tippin spoke to you, he quoted Ronald Reagan about this issue. And my first introduction to this concept actually goes back to the negative income tax, which was proposed by then President Nixon as a way of really providing support for those who are working their way out of poverty. There are a couple of things that I don't think really have been mentioned, or perhaps my memory just doesn't hold it. But one is that in the hearings on the adult and family service budget, when we were talking about TANF, one of the real concerns for Oregon right now is making sure that we meet the maintenance of effort requirements when we went into welfare reform. And the refundability part of this legislation will help us meet that maintenance of effort, because we are reaching out to those who really are part of that whole welfare reform effort. And again, I want to stress what has been stressed before, and that's that our public policy now really does call for work attachment within the welfare system. And so what we are doing here is really making sure that those supports that will allow people to make safe choices for their children will be there, because child care is a concern. This last biennium, I participated with some parents in a project called Parent Voices. And as I heard them talking about the kinds of things that they needed to do particularly because so many people who are within the category of the working poor do not work the 8-to-5 shift. They often have split shifts if they're involved in the hospitality industry, and it is a real difficult time for them as they try to make safe choices. And so what I hope this will do will be assist them in making sure that their children will not be neglected while they're working, which is the public policy of the state of Oregon. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions about any of the history of all of this. Thank you.
Thank you. So we are in a dual hearing right now, is that correct?
That is correct.
I think Mr. Shekstoff wanted to come to plan 2032 also.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Charles Shekstoff from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm pleased to provide you with copies of a summary sheet and tables from a recent report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities on the tax burdens and thresholds of low-income Oregonians. I'll talk about in a moment. And also a summary of a report there that they issue about once every year, once every other year, called A Hand Up. It's about how state earned income credits have worked. That report shows that 10 states have refundable credits, 5 have, like Oregon, or 4 others join Oregon with non-refundable. The EIC is the most effective and targeted method for raising Oregon's low income tax threshold. And it's also the most effective and targeted method for reducing the tax burden on the working poor. Before the EIC is increased, however, it needs to be made refundable because the lowest income earners don't get to fully enjoy it. As I suggested in my memorandum, I believe the refundability provisions of House Bill 2032 should be changed to be like the ones in the Working Family Credit Bill that you just considered, so that's a continuous appropriation and assured to people. The report I've given you shows what the tax threshold and burden is for Oregon. In this summary sheet, which is in your handout, shows the tax threshold is the point of income you start paying taxes based on personal exemption credit and whatnot. It does not it includes the EIC, but doesn't include the working family credit because not everybody has child care costs or the similar child care costs. And this shows that for two-parent families of 4, who are we have the 13th lowest in the nation, one, that's not very good, and then for the single-parent families of 3, we have the 14th lowest. The tax burden is once you're in the threshold, and I like to think of it sort of going through that door, then how high is the ceiling, and is my head going to hit it, or is Representative Bates' head going to hit the ceiling? And you start paying is what is the burden that you have to start paying once you get on the, get hit, are paying taxes. And the Center on Budget looks at income taxes of people at poverty, at 125% of poverty, and at the minimum wage effective in that state. And you can see here that for a family of 4 with incomes at the poverty level, we have the 8th highest in the nation tax burden. For families of 4 with incomes at 125% of poverty, we're the 3rd highest. For families of 3 with incomes at 125% of poverty, we're the 5th highest. Because we have a high minimum wage, we have a lot of people at that level. I mean, a two-person family is above at minimum wage. One wage earner, a single parent with a one child, is at above poverty. So they're at this high tax burden. As you will recall from my earlier presentation, from our report, Prosperity and Perspective, the poverty rate among families with children has doubled in the last 20 years. So there's a lot of people in the workforce at these low levels. We haven't done that analysis at 125%. To raise the tax threshold, you just increase the EIC. But before that happens, again, it should be refundable so that the people at the lowest end get it. And that will also lower the tax burden. We haven't calculated what it would be to bring us to no taxes at poverty or no taxes at 125% under the current tax code. It's somewhere around 14 or 15%. My educated guess from when we calculated it a few years ago, but we can do that. And that's why the EIC should be increased, and it's the only real targeted way to make it to get the benefits to the lowest income people. Increase in a personal exemption credit doesn't do that, but doing it that way does. Now, I also suggested, as I mentioned earlier, that it's a question of priorities, and the Solomon question I got from Representative Bates. If the legislature tomorrow morning passed either the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget, or a combination thereof, and adjourned sine die, the lowest, and did nothing else, the lowest 20% of Oregon taxpayers would get a $7 tax break this year. The top 20% would get a $682 tax break. Middle-income Oregonians would get a $100 tax break. The top 1% would get, who have an income over $200,000, an average income of about $700,000, would get a $4,200 tax break because of the kicker. The kicker is the second largest kicker in the history of Oregon at $336 million. And it happens by doing nothing. And I think it's an issue of budget priorities. Should we help folks who have the third and fifth highest tax burden in the nation, or are we going to just send them $7 by doing nothing? I would suggest that we have some policy choices that could be made by this legislature.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, just thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck, to pursue this for a minute, I assume you would be supportive of raising the personal exemption credit, but it doesn't get to the heart of the issue in the way that a refundable credit will, because those folks who are not paying taxes or are paying very little in taxes aren't getting any additional support with their child care expenses or their living expenses in terms of earned income credit. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, maybe you could clarify. Are you saying as an alternative to the EIC?
No, I guess it's not an alternative, but, I mean, you would take that policy outside of the EIC, wouldn't you?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, no. First, I would say make the personal exemption credit refundable so that 17% of it that's not getting used can get used, or whatever the percentage. My memory serves me right, it's about 17% in the tax expenditure report. And then I think, and Ed can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it does have a phase out. I think it would have to target it at lower income. You'd have to phase it out at the upper incomes who don't need it. Our report, Prosperity and Perspective, showed that of the economic expansion of the 1990s, the upper income people did fine. Middle income people stayed steady. Low income people lost out. Their incomes have not kept up with inflation over the last 20 years. And so I think if you're going to use tax policy to try to address that and what's happening to our economy and to workers, it should reflect what they've gotten out of the economy. And so I'm not in favor of that, certainly as an alternative. I think if I was rewriting the Oregon tax code, I would consider changing it, certainly if the whole tax code was on the table. But I would also make sure that those low-income people, especially the people, because the EIC doesn't really affect people very well who don't have children. And so some of those are the people who are also losing out on the personal exemption credit and the part-time workers.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Chuck, how much of this problem is in terms of the low-income Oregonians losing ground, how much is it based upon the decline in the rural economy in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative, we've tried to look into that a little bit in our report, and I'm going to go back and study it and get back to you on that. Not that much. I mean, it's mostly there's been, what we've been able to tell, it's just that the wages and earnings there's been growing income inequality in the state. The minimum wage has not kept up with inflation, hasn't caught up to where it was in the late 70s, despite the big increase that the voters enacted in 96. And that was a big boost. I mean, low-income people would really be hurting today if that had not happened. We're about to come out with a new report looking at what has happened from the minimum wage increase. But I think the rural economy's had an impact. It's hard to quantify the extent of it. I think sometimes high tech, our report talks about high tech sometimes is given more credit than maybe it's due as far as number of jobs and the nature of the jobs. It's not all high-paid engineers in it at Intel. If you're putting together a printer for Hewlett-Packard, you're also a high-tech worker. And so there's that aspect of it as well. There's been decline in manufacturing jobs in the state. I mean, that's not just happening in rural Oregon. It's happened in the Valley as well and in Portland. So there's, and it's the growth of the service economy and retail trade have grown tremendously in Oregon. And the employment department basically says you're more likely to have a high-paid job or a low-paid job way out in the future. So it's not as much urban-rural, though it's hard to come up with that. There's some of that certainly at play, and I'd be happy to look into that for you and get back to you.
Follow up, Madam Chair. How about in terms of demographics of the workforce? Does it tend to be younger workers, or is it all over?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, our analysis of earnings and whatnot, we looked at, and we generally look at under 64 so that we don't count seniors who are retired and skew things. Or we look at 18 to 64, so we're not counting the 16-year-olds who are skewing things as well. And I think there's some discussion in there about the nature of the workforce. I don't think the declining wages and the fact that the middle-income Oregonians are due to a younger workforce necessarily. People are working more hours, too. That's another thing our report documented. So those are very good questions. I'll look into those, both of you.
How much of it is due to part-time workers? Is there an increase in part-time workers in the economy compared to maybe 10 years ago? Could that explain part of this, or is this based upon simply full-time employees?
Madam Chair and Representative, we looked at household income, which include, when you look at household income, you're picking up the part-time and the second jobs. I mean, a lot of the added hours are because people are part-time, but it's part-time on top of a full-time job or two part-time jobs together, and for totaling more hours than you used to work. So that's sort of a factor in it. I believe the report was distributed last week to your offices. It's called Prosperity and Perspective, and if you are having any difficulty finding it, I know there's too much paper in this building. I'd be happy to send you another copy.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, both 2716 and 2032 are decreased revenue for the state. They aren't expenditures. So I assume they'd affect the kicker. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, no, they wouldn't, because they're decreased revenues to the state in the 2001-2003 biennium. The kicker is, that's why the kicker is a huge kicker. You have a second largest kicker in history of Oregon with a declining long-term revenue forecast. There are two different time periods. The kicker is based on what was the revenue forecast in May of 99 compared to what it is now, and it's gone up so much that we're going to have a huge kicker between now and June expected. It may go down, but that's what's anticipated by the state economists. And then the next biennium $100 million additional problem you heard about last week is them looking out 27, 29 months saying, uh-oh, the economy is not doing as well as we thought back in December by $100
million.
It would, that's right. It could, next biennium, so it doesn't affect the kicker, but if the legislature chose not to let the kicker kick, which you only need a 3/5 vote for, you did not make the 2/3 go into effect until July 1, 2001, in the measure that was referred by the last legislature to the voters, you would have $337 million to go to deal with the next biennium budget.
And do we have a revenue impact for 2032?
Representative Bates, members of the committee, sheet that was passed out now a couple of weeks ago lists some options for refundable earned income credits set at different percentages of the federal earned income credit. Making the existing credit refundable at the 5% rate it is currently would reduce revenues by about $16 million, roughly, in the biennium. Increasing it to 15% of the federal and making it refundable would reduce revenues by about $92 million in the biennium.
Other questions? Thank you. And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2032 and House Bill 2716 and open the hearing on House Bill 2461. And Ed, would you please do your message?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2461 establishes an income tax credit for a married parent who elects to stay home in order to care for children under 13 years of age. It limits the credit to a maximum of 15% of average wages earned by the non-working spouse during prior 5 years, up to $7,500 maximum. The credit has a phase out for each dollar of adjusted gross income above $50,000 for the taxpayer, and it is available or under the bill effective the 2002 tax year and thereafter.
We have Representative Schrader. Can you come to the floor?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and testify in support of House Bill 2461. For the record, I'm Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. I appreciate you hearing this bill. I think it's an excellent complement to the some of the proposals you have been listening to here today, and I know some of you have discussed in past sessions. I'd like to call this our Children and Families First Tax Credit. In my opinion, it's time as a legislature and as representatives of the people of the state of Oregon that we put our money where our mouth is. And by that I mean supporting healthy communities and healthy families. We have parents out there that are making tremendous financial sacrifices to stay at home with their children. And I think this is an opportunity for us to encourage those fortunate kids that have a two-parent household to have that parent stay home at some significant financial risk anyway, but with a recognition by the state of Oregon that, yeah, we acknowledge that you're taking a significant cut in your income to stay home and teach your child, hopefully the values, that keep them out of some of the tougher parts of the system and governmental largesse, to put it politely, that we end up having to deal with. I've seen a lot of that. I'm serving on the Human Resource Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and there are a lot of tough people out there with a lot of tough circumstances and a lot of kids that obviously didn't get good value instruction. To me, this is a front-door policy that complements a lot of the earned income credits that we now have. I think it's kind of a shame if you think about it. We will give tax credits to people that leave their children with strangers who we don't really check out how well their operations are run, to be quite frank. I've also served on that subcommittee on Ways and Means. And yet we give no credit, no money, no support to those that make that sacrifice to stay home. This bill is fairly modest in its credit. However, given our tough budget times, I would suggest to this committee it be made more modest yet. I have a chart that I'm willing to share with the committee that Mr. Waters, I believe, and some others have helped construct about different scenarios about adjusted gross income caps, the relative percentage of credit that we might be talking about. This bill, as was mentioned, talks about a $50,000 cap and a 15% credit. Being on Ways and Means, have to be prudent and fiscally responsible. And I am willing, certainly, to look at different numbers. I've also talked with the House Majority Leader. She, I believe, either is introducing or has introduced a similar bill. She was unaware of our bill. And I think she's working with a $40,000 cap and a 10% credit. My suggestion would be that the total biennial hit to the budget should be in the $10 million range or a little less to make this even remotely real for any add-backs that we have at the end of session. This bill, I'd like to say, was my personal brainstorm, but it came about in, I think, the best way possible, which was a fence-side conversation with a constituent as I was campaigning 4 years ago, Grace Audis in Estacada, a community that's been very hard hit by the timber slowdown in the last 15 years. And her husband was struggling, and she also, and they had to, one of them had to quit their job to take care of the child after the timber industry shut down. And she was saying, geez, Kurt, why can't we do this? You know, I want to stay home with the kids. My husband's tried to find a new job. Isn't there a way, you know, we could get a little something? I don't want a handout. I want some help. I want some help, some recognition that, you know, you respect our decision to stay home and raise our children. And again, as I said, given what I've seen in my brief tenure in the state legislature, it'd be nice to have some of these children grow up with the right value system in our state so they don't fall into the other aspect of our state system. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward. Hopefully this is the right choice for our children and the right choice for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schrader, we had this bill last session, didn't we?
Yes.
Was Representative Loken a co-sponsor of this
bill? Yes, she was. Session? Yes, she was.
Remember what happened to this bill last session?
I don't believe it got out of the committee, actually. I don't think
we had a hearing.
We had a hearing, and I don't believe if we work sessioned it or not. I don't believe we got that far.
Would you see this bill as one that complements and provides a good alternative to the bill that we heard earlier, the Working Family Child Care Credit Bill?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the other half of what needs to happen in the state of Oregon. You know, there are low-income working families that are able to eke by and not maybe qualify for the earned income credit. They could be covered on this side of the spectrum. So I think both are a valuable complement to one another and makes it so that Oregon's covering the full spectrum, perhaps not to the economic degree we'd like, but at least the full spectrum of the families that need help in the state of Oregon. Not a handout, but a hand up as they work their way through our system.
Follow up?
Representative, what if you have a situation where you have spouses, one spouse is making $30,000 a year, other spouse is making $200,000 a year? Spouse A, the first spouse, decides to leave the workforce care for a young child. Would this credit still apply in those circumstances?
I don't believe so. I'd have your staff, but it's a $50,000 cap at this point on that remaining individual, so no, it would not.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Representative Witt, Representative Schrader, members of the committee, that is correct. Someone with, as the bill is written now, with AGI in the current tax year above $50,000 would at the beginning range of the phase out. I think the income, the credit phases out for income between $50,000 and about $60,000.
Okay, so, all right, so for the joint return.
That's correct.
Okay, I understand.
President Bates?
A lot of the other bills we've talked about really are targeting single parent families, of course, and so there is a little difference there, but do you think this bill would have an opportunity to encourage one of the spouses to stay home and raise the kids and be with the kids? I would see that as a real policy issue.
Exactly, and that's the major thrust of this bill is the monetary reward at the $50,000, 15% tax credit. It would have been nice. The tax credit would have been about $1,400. As we lower that because of our fiscal concerns, it gets down in the $900 and $500 range. And certainly that's not a tremendous financial reward, but I think it speaks volumes to those people in Oregon that struggle and say, yeah, I'm going to stay home and raise my kids. It's a great value message that we need to send people here.
Well, if that's the case, would you consider the possibility of a higher percentage for people with lower income? I mean, the amount of money going out is that the family's not that great, but the greatest impact would be not the family is making $50,000 with a couple of kids, but the family making $20,000 and one of them wants to stay home, and I would like to see them get more than the one at $50,000. Would you consider that kind of a?
I'd be okay with that. I don't have a problem with that, and to the extent that that could be done, that would be fine. I guess a comment I'd make, just as an aside, is that part of the genesis of this bill is certain families are used to a certain standard of living, and then they have to cut that. So a person that's used to making $100,000 a year combined incomes, two families, so $50,000 each, a big chunk of change, they go down. The other family, it's not as big a drop. They're used to a little different standard of living. But I think you've got an excellent point, and I'd be more than willing to entertain that type of amendment.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Schrader, do you know of any other states that have a similar program?
Actually, I do not. I don't know. I have not looked into it.
Representative Schrader, myself, and there are several of us here. I applaud your effort to do this. I was just wondering, though, divorced parents, of which there are unfortunately many, sometimes fall into this same dilemma and how there might be incentives to accomplish the same goal.
Sure. Well, hopefully the bills you have been hearing, their earned income credits would allow them to be taken care of also, to the extent that financial reasons, young people today are getting very creative about how to make ends meet. And to the extent there's not irreconcilable differences, I would hope that some of the marriage penalty things that we do have going on would not encourage them to go to an earned income, to get divorced on the books, to qualify for some of the credits when there's another option for them to stay, quote, married, and be able to also get a little recognition, a little credit for their children, for their service. Young people today are very creative.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Hopefully move it a little further this time, right?
Anybody else who would like to testify on House Bill 2461? Three for three.
I'm Chair Representative. Members of the committee, I'm Charles Shekatoff, the Oregon Center for Policy. I think this bill is well-intentioned, but I think there's some serious problems with it, and it's not a very good idea. I think there's certain enforcement problems. How do you know that? I mean, I think there's an assumption, for instance, that if the person's at home, they're taking care of their kids. There's no way of enforcing that. Someone could afford to quit and play golf every day. They'd get the credit. I think that there's assumptions that being with the family is the best thing, and I think while we'd love to believe that, we also know there's a reason there's an Oregon Children's Plan floating around this building is because that's not always the best situation for a child. That's why we have a Services to Children and Families Agency. I think it's also in relation to the working family credit and the earned income credit, those are not for single parents. The earned income credit actually has been argued on the federal level to keep families together because if you get divorced, only one person gets the credit. And it actually worked. There's a marriage penalty in the earned income credit, which I don't fully understand how to explain it, but it does work to keep people together. And it's for two-parent families, and so is the working family credit. There's a number of two-parent families, and your chair at the moment is one of those who have child care costs. And that's what both of those bills address. I think that it also should be dealt with, I think, in the context of the bigger policy of do we want to encourage parents to stay home? If that's the case, I think that this should be looked at, but that's a much bigger policy question than a tax credit. I think there's a whole slew of policies in this state that we don't encourage people to be home. From the minimum wage, what are we paying the one parent who's working, to the quality of child care, and training for being parents and whatnot. So in the broader tax reform and policy, I think it's a subject that certainly deserves attention, but I think as designed, and this was discussed in response to Representative Witt's question, this was discussed last year as actually an attempt to add this to Senate Bill 2, and the amendment failed in the Revenue Committee. If I recall right, I don't know if it actually got moved, but I know it was discussed as a part of that. I just think there's some serious enforcement problems for the Revenue Department. I mean, the Revenue Department is incredibly efficient. They're a very small department, and they bring in $10 billion. You know, compare that to the Department of Human Services, how much money they spend out and how many people they have. And the reason is because you have to enforce and have rules on who gets it. If you're going to assume someone's going to be staying with their children, you got to make sure that's going to that person, not to the golfer. I think that's one of the serious problems with this, and it's not targeted well. And the working family credit, I mean, the earned income credit goes up with inflation. It's now about $30,000. That's up to about $30,000. Families can get it. So if you want to target families who are staying home or help folks, and maybe with the idea that this will encourage them to stay home, increase the earned income credit. Simple. Just increase it. Make it refundable and increase it, and you'll do the same thing. And it'll be targeted towards low-income people, and you can have your hope that means more people will stay home. But I don't think the bill does that. I think it just goes to someone who can afford to quit work and get a little bonus from the state for quitting work. And I don't think we should be paying people who can afford to do that.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't disagree with you on some of the enforcement issues, Chuck, but one thing I liked about that approach is I've heard over the years the complaints by the middle class that there are all these programs designed to help the low income, and that's appropriate, and the rich don't need these programs, but it's the middle class families that do have to struggle with having a choice between having one spouse stay at home and having to deal with it. I mean, that's the real world. And so while that bill may not be perfect, it does get to that thing that I think we all want to do, which is help to some middle-class families.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, some states have taken their earned income credits and expanded them and made them more generous. And don't, in ours, the beauty of ours is you just take a percent of the federal, and that's what most states do. So you can expand it that way. You can target it. I think the fact of the matter is, as far as that chart that I've neglected to turn off up there shows, low-income people are really hurting as far as the tax code goes. Oregon could do a child tax credit. I would urge you, if you thought of just doing a child tax credit, you didn't do what the federal government did, which is make it non-refundable so low-income people don't get it. And I don't think you have to pit low-income people versus middle-income people either, okay? I think that's sort of a false fight to have. The earned income credit goes up to a fairly high income level. The working family credit goes up to a significant one, as you saw on that chart. And so, because it's up to 250% of poverty, and that's a fairly high figure compared to the median income in the state and the average incomes and whatnot.
Chuck, I read an article in Oregonian maybe a month or so ago, and I don't have the study that they were citing, but it talked about the fact that most families where one parent stays home are actually on the lower end of the economic scale, as opposed to, and there's kind of this new trend that I've seen of it's hip now for upper middle class women who can afford to stay home, professional women, you know, quit work and stay home with their children. But the study really showed that most people that have one parent staying home are in the lower income. Do you have any comments on that? Or?
I'm not familiar with that study. So it's a study of two-parent households who is staying home. And it wouldn't surprise me, but the reason they're staying home is because of the high cost of child care. Mm-hmm. And I think, so I won't make the claim that the working family credit by becoming refundable is going to get them into the workforce, right? But it would help, I mean, it might make some changes on that. But I think people do pen out, boy, if I work half-time at minimum wage, can I really afford child care? Child care providers, you know, have slots. And so they don't like to just divvy up a few hours here or a few hours there. If you're working part-time, it's hard to find child care. And so, and especially with young children. So it wouldn't surprise me that low-income people can pan out the math that it's cheaper not to work than to go into debt, further debt, to have child care. I think child care is sort of an interesting aspect in the whole discussion about education. For some reason, even though, you know, and we all know early brainhood development is important and all that stuff's important, it's not a part of our education system. It's not a part of your decisions about K-12 funding. It's not child care through 12. And even though there's some studies which suggest it's actually more, if you don't do it before K, you're in trouble at K, right? And so until it's funded and it becomes affordable, I don't think until it becomes a public thing, it's going to truly be affordable to have quality care, just like education is now affordable because it's a public thing. You're going to have that people having to make those very difficult choices.
Well, I still see this as a policy issue. Do we want to encourage strong families by making it a little easier for one spouse to stay home and help raise kids? I don't think they're going to play golf, by the way. And I really think that's a little disingenuous to say that. I think most of these families that have a chance to stay home will stay home and take care of those kids. Or do we want to encourage a policy that says we'd rather have you out in the workforce and we'll help pay for child care for you? And that's a broad, very broad policy. There's lots of room in between there. I agree with Representative Haas that I think that we have to look at this carefully, think about it carefully, what our real policy is. Do we want to encourage people to stay home with the children or not? And we do. And if that's the case, then instead of just talking the talk, maybe this is a chance to walk the walk.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, there is a slew of policies in the state that aren't to stay home. From the welfare policy for one- and two-parent families that 90 days after the day of birth of a child, you have to get back in the workforce and start participating in their welfare program, jobs program. There's a whole bunch of them. So I'm not sure it's the state of Oregon's policy that we want one parent to stay home. You know, we don't teach as a mandatory course in high school how to take care of a child. okay? And so, I mean, I just don't think that that's the policy of the state necessarily. I think it's a good discussion to have, but this credit is not reflecting a broader state policy that we absolutely have. I think there's a lot of conflicting policies with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2461 and recess or adjourn. Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Yes. All right. Thank you.